This is Liner Note Leftovers, your weekly musical discovery hosted by 106.1 The GOAT's resident crate digger, Dan Soul. Let's dive in.
Good day, good morning, good noon, good evening, good night, and all of the usual pleasantries of whatever time and space you may be listening to Liner Note Leftovers in, but welcome to episode 21 of your favorite virtual crate dig, and this week's episode is called The Right Place at the Right Time. In this week's episode, we got a little Canadian band showing up at the right Led Zeppelin concert in Toronto and changing the rock world because of it. We got a bunch of kids who showed up to support a little-known band called Nirvana, and ended up becoming a part of a Gen X anthem just for one boring day on a music video filming lot. What else were you doing that day that was just as big? And, this one's a little dubious, but is it possible that David Bowie and Mick Jagger, giving each other the goods in the right way, y'all know what I mean, could it have inspired one of the greatest Rolling Stones ballads of all time? It's just one of many theories. We also got some stories that earned that little question mark in our title of whether or not it was the right place. One involving Alice Cooper almost getting hard rock banned from the city of Toronto. And from the archives of Liner Note Leftovers, a story involving a dude who should not have been at a Smashing Pumpkins concert, but was at a Smashing Pumpkins concert, and it ended just about as well as we could hope. Now, I'm not going to tell you anymore. I don't want to spoil your appetite for destruction, so let's drop that needle and get into this week's Liner Note Leftovers. If you really sit down and think about it, the amount of history you've maybe Forrest Gumped your way into, you didn't know it at the time, but it was historical, is probably pretty astronomical. But I want you to picture thinking that you're just showing up at some band's music video for a few bucks and a sandwich, and it becomes the Generation X anthem. Well, that's true in the case of anybody who was at the taping of Smells Like Teen Spirit, which was taken at the GMT Studios in LA on August 17th, 1991. Now, we all know what it looks like. It's a play on a high school that's been gussied up to look like the 11th circle of hell. That's actually true, is exactly as it was described. But on this hot August day, or at least the days leading up to it, Kurt Cobain and the rest of Nirvana were hanging out at the Roxy. They weren't playing, they were just hanging out and handing out flyers. Hey, you want to be in this music video? You need to be 18 to 25 and be able to adapt to a high school persona like a preppy, a punk, a nerd, or a jock. Be at GMT Warehouse G. Be ready to stay for several hours. Come support Nirvana. Now, it was funny because a lot of these kids didn't even really know who Nirvana was yet. Some did, but not everybody. But they're like, hell, I'll show up. I want to be in a music video. Maybe I can be on MTV. So all these kids are not actors, and they're not used to being on set. In fact, the only people who were used to acting for a long period of time were the people that director Sam Bayer hired as the cheerleaders, who were strippers. That's what they were. Director Sam Bayer had been scouting clubs and decided to hire up these girls so that they could get the cheerleader moved down and that kind of thing. They would actually know how to dance just a little bit. Kurt Cobain didn't like this because he's like, what are we doing here? Making a Van Halen music video? What is this, Motley Crue? That's not what we're going here, man. But Bayer rebutted with, yeah, but the whole video's super dirty. Nobody's gonna know. It's all yellows and browns. It's the exact antithesis of what you're gonna see on MTV. So they finally get it down and they're gonna make this music video, and it does not go very well, I guess is the right way to say it. Because, aforementioned, nobody's an actor, including the band. So Nirvana's already bored of playing Teen Spirit over and over and over again. And if it's bad for the band, it's worse for the audience. That's true every time. Kids were getting antsy. They were getting restless. Some of them had maybe snuck off for a sip and a to just get them through the day. So finally, at the end, Kurt Cobain's like, okay, we got to give these kids something. They're going to lose their minds. So for the final take of the music video, Sam Bayer gets up and says, all right, guys, one more time, but just go ahead and get up and destroy everything. Start a mosh pit. Break the instruments, tear down the set. And that's just the spark that these kids need to make the perfect visual to end this music video. But at first, they do all this work and MTV decides we're not gonna play it. Too dark, too grungy to be on our station. It was actually, thankfully, an MTV music programmer named Amy Finnerty who was a little ingenious in stepping up for Nirvana. When the Smashing Pumpkins visited MTV Studios, she showed the Pumpkins the music video. So MTV's not gonna listen to this nowhere band, but they're gonna listen to the Smashing Pumpkins, who are already established and working with them. Teen Spirit would debut a month later on September 29th during 120 Minutes, which was a later show dedicated to alternative music, and it was like a bomb went off. The Gen X anthem hit. 120 Minutes host David Kendall says, "Hell, even I would have pushed for it to be world premiered in primetime if I knew what it was gonna be." But with or without that primetime debut, I think it did pretty okay. It only became a Gen X anthem or whatever. There's been a lot of bands that have formed just from seeing the right concert at the right time. The Beatles at Shea Stadium, the Sex Pistols at the Lesser Free Trade Hall, and for the trio known as Rush, seeing Led Zeppelin at the Rock Pile, which was a former Masonic temple. So here's how it sort of went down. The trio that would eventually become the first incarnation of Rush, which was Alex Lifeson, Geddy Lee, and John Rutsey, are all trying to get tickets to go see Zeppelin on August 18th, 1969. Alex Lifeson and John Rutsey managed to scrape some money together, but for some reason, Geddy Lee can't. According to him, he had to hawk a family heirloom typewriter that had been given to him by his grandmother to scrape together enough coin to go see. So success, he sheepishly, guiltily takes the money, and they go to Mighty Monday, line up extra early, and end up in the second row right in front of Jimmy Page. And according to Lee, he says, they floated on stage, ripped into killer versions of classics, and by the end, the plaster was coming off the roof of this old building. And right then and there, the boys had been tooling with the idea of being a musician permanently for life, but this is the kick in the pants they need to get down this pathway permanently. The boys get together, they run down to Sam the Record Man, the legendary record shop in Toronto, and pick up every Zeppelin album they can get. They load up, they learn to play every tune, but according to Geddy Lee, they tried to pull off the Zeppelin covers in the bar scene they were playing in. Couldn't really do it, though they did have Livin' Lovin' Maid in their set for a long time. And then eventually, they start writing their own songs that would take 5 years to amalgamate into the self-titled Rush debut. And another right place, right time, legendary music director of the rock station WMMS-FM, Donna Halper, gets a copy of this album, and it falls into the right hands, because even though she's at an American station in Cleveland, she's dead set into Canadian bands. She'd been the first to play Bruce Cockburn, Murray McLaughlin, French Canadian bands. And according to her, she would get albums all the time because, quote, Toronto radio was going through a wimpy, mellow jello phase. Hard rock got no airplay and no Canadian labels would sign Rush. But she gets this album, drops the needle, hears the song Working Man, and understands that this band is going to be huge. She goes to bat for them, gets them airplay all across Cleveland. Eventually, it starts blossoming from there. Even if radio DJs did have to field a lot of awkward calls about early Rush and saying, hey, when's the new Zeppelin album coming out? That sounds good. Eventually, Rush would be finding their way. See what I did there? And the rest is how you say history. Now, don't worry. Geddy Lee's family got their typewriter back, the family heirloom. Rush ended up making it big, and in a perfect meet your heroes moment, at a hotel in Morocco, Geddy Lee and Robert Plant meet. They become pen pals and good friends. And eventually, when Rush was in its darkest times, after, of course, Neil Peart lost his daughter, Robert Plant was the first guy to call, get those guys back together, and get them back smiling, rip-roaring, ready to play once again. So tell me at least it's not sometimes good to meet your heroes, maybe emulate them just a little bit. I don't know, give this one a rip and see if you can't spot the similarities. It seems to me If it isn't evidenced by the amount of stories we've told now, Canadians seem to love riots for some reason. There's riots mentioned in songs, there's riots because of hockey games, and there's riots because bands are not living up to our expectations. Metallica knows that, Guns N' Roses knows that, and Alice Cooper knows that because of a disastrous show at the Canadian National Exhibition in Toronto on August 19th, 1980. Let me paint a picture for you. Let me set the scene. It's the last day of the CNE. About 13,000 Alice Cooper fans are at the grandstand. Some of them been drinking. Some of them are a little, you know. And some of them, all of them in fact, have been boiling on a extra hot Toronto summer night. So before Alice Cooper is set to come on, a hometown prog rock band named Zon plays 30 minutes of what has been described as torturous space jams. It's a lot of noodling, a lot of fumble, and nothing particularly that good. So after a half hour, they get off the stage, and it takes another 90 minutes for Alice Cooper's roadies to set up for the Welcome to My Nightmare show. It's hot, it's sweaty, lights are coming up and down and on and back. Total tease moments. Somebody has to hit the stage and say, hey, Alice Cooper might be a little bit late. He lost some luggage at Pearson. He can't be without his costumes, his makeup, or his snake, right? They understand. But as storm clouds begin to roll in and the temperature continues to spike, accounts of the day said the room quickly became a foggy hothouse of anger, smoke, and sweat. Till finally at the point at 10:05 p.m., Alice Cooper's lead guitarist, his name's Dick Wagner, comes on stage and says, Alice is sick. Turns out he actually has some pretty bad bronchial problems. He can't play tonight, but hey guys, Zon would be more than happy to come back and play more space jams. And I wonder if you could hear the audible, no, as this happened, because even before Wagner was finished, chairs were flying up on stage. People were losing their minds. This got so bad so quickly that every Toronto police officer that wasn't extremely indisposed was brought to the CNE. So there are cops on horses, people fighting, midway stalls and food trucks were looted, a streetcar got pushed over. If you've ever seen a Toronto streetcar, they are huge and on cables. It would take a lot to push one of these things over. You gotta be big mad. Now, whether or not you believe Alice Cooper actually had a bronchial infection or there were other reasons at play, I'm gonna leave it on this, because you can't just blame Alice Cooper for being the rock and roll star that corrupts the children, which of course was thrown around after this, because it wasn't the only riot that summer. A Nash the Slash concert had ended in a riot. A show a couple of months earlier by my hometown hero's teenage head, Hamilton Represent, had also ended in a streetcar flipping riot that had heavy metal and hard rock banned from Ontario plays for years. I don't think it was so much about alienation, Satan, or anything else you want to blame this on. I think it's just Canadians love riots at a certain point. Think about it, we've done it more times at a rock concert than most people, let's be honest. But Alice Cooper, the man, was a riot, according to his merch buttons, and in real life. It's funny how it imitates art sometimes, isn't it? You know, of all the Rolling Stones songs out there, Angie is perhaps one of the ones that has the biggest air of mystery around it. Because firstly, it's a mystery this song ever got done at all, because the boys were recording it in Jamaica during a period of recording where, by their own admission, they were, quote, just farting around. Though that might not necessarily have been their fault, because they said they had to deal with armed escorts and locked studios for the whole duration they were in there. It's a mystery why Mick Jagger's ghost vocals were left on the track, which are basically just used as a guide for the rest of the band to know how to keep in time. But the biggest mystery of all is, who is Angie? Because even the Rolling Stones themselves can't definitively tell you who she is. There's about three or four different theories, each stranger than the last, and let's chat about them. Was it about Angie Dickinson, who was at the height of her popularity in the 60s and 70s? Is the song nothing more more than a fantasy about an actress, because as far as I know, the Stones and Angie Dickinson have no connection. Plausible, but there might be more to it. Is it about a salacious and juicy rumor regarding the intimate feelings of Mick Jagger and David Bowie? Well, that's a theory that's been propagated by none other than David Bowie's first wife, Angela Barrett. Angie. Some people might tell you, herself included, the song was written as a bribe to keep the torrid Jagger-Bowie affair under wraps. But then again, watch the Dancing in the Street music video. Those two were not hiding anything well. Trust me, from one to another, I know. Was it about Maureen Faithfull? And some scholars of the Stones would say, oh God, not another song about Maureen Faithfull. I mean, think about it. When the list of songs that are either about her or rumored to be about her include Sympathy for the Devil, You Can't Always Get What You Want, Wild Horses, I Got the Blues, She Smiled Sweetly, Winter, She's Like a Rainbow, 100 Years Ago, and Let's Spend the Night Together. It's not the most outlandish theory. However, Keith Richards wrote the song, not Mick Jagger. So maybe Jagger's contributions were about the Maureen Faithfull breakup, but we can't confirm that it's anything more than that. Is it about Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany? And I know what you're thinking, Dan, that's really stupid. Back off. Well, some people believe it. She was young once, may have met the Stones, had a rendezvous. She did use it as her 2005 campaign song, much to the chagrin of the Stones, so I don't know if there was a lot of love there, but it's a theory. But let's get down to brass tacks, because the widely accepted theory is that Angie was written by Keith Richards about Dandelion Angela Richards, who is his baby daughter, born while he was in rehab in 72. But even then, that can't be confirmed, because even though in Keith Richards' book Life, he said, yes, it's about my daughter, other times he says, when he was finally not messed up enough in rehab to get his fingers working again playing the guitars, he just picked a name at random and would just noodle the guitar to figure out a song. But you know what I like to think? Anybody who listens to that song has a different Angie in mind. They might not even be named Angie. It's just one of those placeholder names for a love song ballad. And I don't think I'm alone in my theory, because even though it was not the same sound that the Stones were putting out in the early 70s, a rare ballad of the time, and even rare acoustic song, it was the Stones' only number one ballad, and their only number one for the next 5 years. So I would not be offside in saying that people built an emotional connection to the song, even if nobody knows whose it's about. Make your own judgments as we give it a listen right now. Okay, show of hands here, people. How many people probably have some form of tinnitus that you can blame on heavy metal rock concerts? Come on, get those hands up. Mine are up too. I feel it. But did you know that you could apparently sue bands for that? Because it was on this day in 1999 that the Smashing Pumpkins, Atlantic Records, and their two opening bands, The Frogs and Fountain of Wayne, were sued by a Princeton University music professor named Peter Jeffrey because he claimed they ruined his hearing at a 1997 concert that he took his son to. And his whole crux of the lawsuit was, well, I just wanted to take my kid to the show, and I was going to hang out in the parents' room because I don't go to rock concerts. I'm a musical professor in Gregorian chant and folk music, but that was being used by Fountains of Wayne, so I had to go actually into the concert hall and listen to all of these bands play. He claimed that this one show had given him tinnitus. He couldn't sleep. He couldn't do his work, because you got to be able to listen to audio if you're a music professor. Also, during this lawsuit, he sued the manufacturers of the earplugs that he had in his ear didn't protect him, and that the amps had been pushed up to 11, which, if you look at an amp, is not a real setting, no matter what Spinal Tap tells you. And apparently there is legal precedent for this as well, too, because a year prior, a lawsuit had resulted in monetary settlement after somebody got tinnitus from a and I'm not making this up, I swear, not making this up, a Barry Manilow concert. But to tie it all back, this lawsuit really didn't go anywhere. Though it did inspire more people to start selling earplugs at their concerts, lest Fountains of Wayne playing Stacy's mom or the Smashing Pumpkins playing Cherub Rock is a little too hard for your sensitive ears. I'm sorry, I know I'm being dismissive, but Royal Blood blew my eardrums out twice in a row and I'll still go see them in concert, so quit your whining.
And cleanliness is godliness, and God is empty, just like me.
I will spare you the heartbreak of a clever metaphor to just let you know that this week's episode of Liner Note Leftovers has reached its conclusion. Hopefully you know a little bit more than you knew before, including the backstories of one of the greatest anthems of Gen X, how being at the right concert at the right time can make you either famous or infamous, and let's face it, you're still picturing that Mick Jagger David Bowie trice. It's pretty hot, right, isn't it? No? Just me? Yeah, even my fellow friends of Dorothy think that one's weird. Next week, we will have 5 new stories from the hallowed halls of rock and roll. What are they going to be about? Well, that's the mystery. But hey, if you want one featured on Liner Note Leftovers, you got a cool story you feel like the world should know, give me a show. My day job is 106.1 The Goat. You can email me at danielmsoul@gmail.com. We'll start a dialogue there. And hey, if you're a fan of the show, drop us a rating where you listen to podcasts. It's a little thing, but it's a huge, huge help for the show. It gets it in more people's ear holes, and eventually we can make this a powerhouse thing. But right now, I'm having a good time in our little virtual record store, digging through the liner notes, and just having a time every single week. So I'll see you next time, and don't forget, always grab life and your vinyl by the edges.
That's a wrap on this week's episode. For more musical discoveries with Dan Soul, head to MyLloydMinsterNow.com or subscribe to Liner Note Leftovers wherever you get your podcast fix.